even upon those follies in which I had so small a share. Prompted by the cardinal, the king felt extreme resentment. Madame de Vernet was dismissed, Poutanges was banished, and Madame de Chevreuse was disgraced. And do you not remember, my lord, that when you wished to return as an ambassador to France, it was His Majesty himself by whom you were opposed? Yes, and France is about to pay with a war for that opposition. I cannot see you again, madame. Well, I will take care that you shall continually hear of me. What do you suppose to have been the true aim of that expedition to Ray, and that league which I am projecting with the Protestants? The delight of seeing you! I am well enough aware that I have no chance of reaching Paris at the head of an army. But then this war must bring about a peace. Peace will require negotiations, and those negotiations shall be made by none but me. They will no longer dare to reject me then. And I shall return to Paris, and behold you once again, and be for an instant happy. It is but too true that my enjoyment will have been bought by the blood of thousands of human beings, but what will their lives be to me, provided that my eyes are blessed once more by seeing you? This may be folly, madame, perhaps madness, but tell me, pray, had ever woman a more impassioned lover, had ever a queen a more enthusiastic servant? My lord, the witnesses you call for your defense accuse you. These very proofs that you would give me of your love are themselves almost crimes. But only because you do not love me, madame. Oh, if you loved me, how different would these circumstances seem? But the joy would be too great, and I should go mad. You spoke but now, madame, of Madame de Chevreuse. But oh, how much less cruel was that lady than you are! Holland loved her, and she responded to his love. Madame de Chevreuse was not a queen, murmured Anne of Austria, subdued in spite of herself by the expression of a passion so profound. And would you then love me if you were not? Oh, tell me, madame, say that you would love me. Let me believe that it is but the dignity of your rank that has come between you and me. Let me believe that if you had been but Madame de Chevreuse, there might have been hope for the unhappy Buckingham. O charming queen, thanks for these sweet words. A thousand, thousand thanks. Alas, my lord, you have misunderstood me. I did not mean to let you infer—
Hush, hush, exclaimed the duke. Be not so cruel as to correct an error that is so full of happiness to me. You have yourself told me that I have been drawn into a snare, and I perhaps shall leave my life in it, for strangely enough, for some time I have had presentiments of an approaching death. And the duke smiled, with a sad yet winning smile.
Oh, God! Exclaimed the queen, in a tone of terror, which manifested, more fully than she might have wished, her interest in the duke.
But I did not tell you this to alarm you, madame. No, it is even ridiculous to speak of it, and believe me, I do not give importance to such silly dreams. But the words which you have just uttered, the hope which you almost gave me, would be a recompense for everything, even for my life.
Oh, but I— said Anne of Austria. I also have had my presentiments. I dreamed that I saw you stretched upon the earth, all bloody from a wound.
On the left side, and inflicted by a knife, was it not? Said the duke.
Yes, my lord. It was in the left side, and by a knife. But who could have told you of my dream? I have never spoken of it but in my prayers to God.
I ask for no more. You love me, madame. Yes, you love me.
I love you?
Yes, you! Would God send to you the same dreams as to me if you did not love me? Should we be visited by the same presentiments if our two existences did not meet in our hearts? Yes, queen, you love me and you weep for me.
Oh, my God, exclaimed the queen. This is more than I can bear. In the name of heaven, my lord, withdraw. I know not whether I love you or not. But this I know, that I will never break my vow at the altar. Have pity on me, then, and leave this kingdom. Oh, if you should be wounded in France,
If you should die in France, if I could imagine that your love for me had been the cause of your death, I should never be consoled. The thought would madden me. Depart, then, depart, I beseech you.
Oh, how beautiful you are now! How devotedly I love you! Exclaimed Buckingham.
Depart, I implore you, and return hereafter, continued the Queen. Come back as an ambassador, as a minister. Come back surrounded by your guards who will defend you, and your servants who will watch over you, and then I shall have no fear for your life, and shall have some happiness in seeing you.
Oh, but is it really true what you now tell me?
Yes.
Give me then some pledge of your regard, some object which has once been yours, to satisfy me that I have not been indulging in a dream, something that you have once worn, and that I may wear now, a ring, a necklace, or a chain.
And will you go if I give you what you ask?
Yes.
Immediately?
Yes.
You will quit France, and will return to England?
Yes, I swear I will.
Wait, then. Wait, sir.
And Anne of Austria returned to her chamber, and came back almost in an instant, holding in her hand a small casket of rosewood with her monogram encrusted in gold.
Here, my lord, here, keep this as a memorial of me.
Buckingham took the casket and again sank upon his knee.
You promised me to go, said the queen,
and I will keep my word. Your hand, madame, and I leave you. Closing her eyes and leaning on Doña Estefana, for she felt her strength was failing her, Anne of Austria extended her hand. On that beautiful hand, Buckingham pressed his lips passionately, and then arose. "Before 6 months have passed," said he, "if I be not dead, I will see you again, if I must turn the world upside down to accomplish it." And, true to his promise, he rushed out of the room. In the corridor he found Madame Bonancieux awaiting him, and, with the same precaution and the same good fortune, she led him forth out of the Louvre. 13. Monsieur Bonancieux. There was in all this affair, as might be remarked, a person of whom, in spite of his precarious situation, we have appeared to take very little notice. This person was Monsieur Bonancieux, a respectable martyr to the political and amorous intrigues which so thoroughly entangled themselves together in that chivalrous and gallant age. Fortunately, as our readers may or may not remember, we have promised not to lose sight of him. The officers who had arrested him conducted him at once to the Bastille, where he had to pass, all trembling as he was, before a company of soldiers who were charging their muskets. Taken from there into a partly subterraneous gallery, he had to endure the most brutal insults and ill-treatment. The attendants saw that he was not a nobleman, and they treated him therefore like a beggar. In about half an hour, a registrar came to put an end to his tortures, but not to his anxiety, by ordering that he should be conducted to the question chamber. They generally questioned prisoners in their own cells, but they did not observe so much ceremony with Monsieur Bonancieux. Two guards laid hold of the mercer, and made him cross a court, and then, entering a corridor where there were three sentinels, they opened a door and pushed him into a low room, which only contained a table, a chair, and a commissary. The commissary was seated on the chair, and was engaged in writing at the table. The two guards led the prisoner to the table, and at a signal from the commissary went out of earshot. The commissary, who had till then kept his head bent down over his papers, raised it up to see who he had before him. This commissary was a man with a very crabbed look, a sharp nose, cheeks yellow and puffed out, small but piercing eyes, and with a countenance reminding one at the same time of a polecat and a fox. His head, supported by a long and flexible neck, was thrust out of his full black robe, and balanced itself with a motion very much like that of a turtle putting its head out of its shell. He began by asking Monsieur Bonancieux his Christian name and surname, his age, profession, and place of abode. The accused replied that his name was Jacques Bonancieux, that his age was 51 years, that he was a retired mercer, and lived in the Rue des Fossoyeurs, number 11. Instead of continuing his questions, the commissary then made him a long speech on the danger of an obscure citizen interfering in public affairs. With this exordium he combined an exposition of the power and actions of the cardinal, that incomparable minister, the conqueror of all preceding ministers, and the example for all future ministers, whom no one could oppose or thwart with impunity. After this second part of his discourse, he fixed his hawk's eye on poor Bonancieux, and exhorted him to reflect upon the seriousness of his situation. This the mercer had already done. He wished Monsieur de la Porte at the devil for having put it into his head to marry his goddaughter, and cursed the hour when that goddaughter had been received into the Queen's service. The foundation of Monsieur Bonancieux's character was profound selfishness, mingled with sordid avarice, the whole being seasoned with excessive cowardice. The love which he entertained towards his young wife was quite a secondary sentiment, and could not stand against those primary feelings which we have just enumerated. Bonancieux, in fact, reflected on what had been said to him.
"But, Mr. Commissary," he timidly observed, "believe me that I know well and appreciate the incomparable merit of His Eminence, by whom we have the honour of being governed."
"Really?" said the commissary, with a doubtful look. "But if this be true, how came you to be in the Bastille?"
"How I am there, or rather, why I am there," replied Bonancieux, "is what it is utterly impossible for me to tell you, seeing that I do not know myself. But most certainly it is not for having offended the cardinal, consciously at least."
"It is certain, nevertheless, that you must have committed some crime, as you are here accused of high treason."
"Of high treason?" cried Bonancieux, confounded. "Of high treason? And how can you believe that a poor mercer who hates the Huguenots and abhors the Spaniards can be accused of high treason? Reflect, sir, the thing is a moral impossibility."
"Monsieur Bonancieux," said the commissary, regarding the accused with his little eyes, as though he had the power of looking into the very depths of his heart, "Monsieur Bonancieux, you have a wife."
"Yes, sir," replied the trembling mercer, perceiving that it was on her account that he was now about to be inculpated. "That is to say, I had one."
"What? You had one? And what have you done with her that you have her no longer?"
"Someone has carried her off, sir."
"Someone has taken her from you?" said the commissary. "Ah."
Bonancieux perceived by this "ah" that matters were getting worse and worse.
"Someone has taken her from you," resumed the commissary. "And do you know who has been guilty of this abduction?"
"I think I know."
"Who is it?"
"Remember that I affirm nothing, Mr. Commissary. I only suspect."
"Whom do you suspect? Come, don't hesitate to speak."
Monsieur Bonancieux was in the greatest perplexity. Ought he to deny everything, or to confess? From a total denial it might be inferred that he knew too much to admit, and by a general confession he might give evidence of his good faith. He determined, therefore, to have no concealments.
"I suspect," said he, "a tall, dark man of lofty air, who has all the appearance of a man of rank. He followed us, I think, many times when I went to fetch my wife from the gate of the Louvre."
The commissary appeared somewhat disturbed.
"And his name?" said he.
"Oh, as to his name, I do not know it. But if I should meet him, I could recognize him amongst 1,000 persons."
The brow of the commissary grew dark.
"You could recognize him amongst 1,000, you say?" continued he.
"That is to say," replied Bonancieux, who saw that he had made a false step, "that is to say..."
"You have said that you could recognize him," said the commissary. "Very well. That is enough for today. It is necessary, before we proceed any further, that someone should be informed that you know the person who has carried off your wife."
"But I did not tell you that I knew him," cried Monsieur Bonancieux in despair. "I told you, on the contrary..."
"Take away the prisoner," exclaimed the commissary to the two guards.
"Where to?" asked the registrar.
"To a dungeon."
"To which?"
"Oh, to the first that offers, provided it be secure," answered the commissary, with an indifference which filled the breast of poor Bonancieux with horror and dismay.
"Alas! Alas!" said he. "I am undone! My wife must have committed some frightful crime, and I am supposed to be an accomplice and shall be punished with her. She must have said something, have confessed that I was her confidant. A woman is such a weak creature. A dungeon, the first that offers. That's it. A night is soon past, and then tomorrow to the wheel, to the gibbet. Oh, my God! Oh, my God, have pity on me!
Without in the least attending to the lamentations of Master Bonacieux, that were of a kind to which they were tolerably well accustomed, the two guards took him by the arms and led him away, while the commissary hastily wrote a letter for which his officer waited. Bonacieux did not close an eye, not because his dungeon was very uncomfortable, but because his anxiety was very great. He sat upon his stool the whole night, trembling at every noise, and when the first rays of light penetrated his chamber, Aurora herself appeared to him to be dressed in funereal array. Suddenly he heard the bolts withdrawn, and gave a terrible start. He believed that they were coming to conduct him to the scaffold, and, therefore, when he saw that it was only the commissary and his attendant, he was almost ready to embrace them.
"Your affair has become sadly complicated since last evening, my fine fellow," said the commissary. "I advise you to tell the whole truth, for your repentance alone can mitigate the anger of the cardinal."
"But I am ready to tell everything," said Bonacieux. "Everything, at least, that I know. Question me, I beseech you."
"In the first place, where is your wife?"
"I've just told you that someone has carried her off."
"Yes, but since 5 o'clock yesterday evening, thanks to you, she has escaped."
"My wife escaped?" cried Bonacieux. "Oh, the wretch! Sir, if she has escaped, I assure you it is not my fault."
"What were you doing, then, in the apartment of your neighbor, Monsieur D'Artagnan, with whom you had a long conference in the course of the day?"
"Ah, yes, Mr. Commissary, yes, that is true. And I confess I was wrong in that. Yes, I was in Monsieur D'Artagnan's apartments."
"And why?"
"To entreat him to assist me in finding my wife. I thought I had a right to reclaim her. I was mistaken, it appears, and I humbly beg your pardon."
"And what answer did Monsieur D'Artagnan give?"
"Monsieur D'Artagnan promised me his assistance, but I soon perceived that he betrayed me."
"You would mislead justice. Monsieur D'Artagnan made an agreement with you, and in virtue of that agreement he put to flight the officers who had arrested your wife, and has now secreted her from all our researches."
"Monsieur D'Artagnan has hidden away my wife? Alas, what do you tell me?"
"Fortunately, Monsieur D'Artagnan is in our power, and you shall be confronted with him."
"Ah, faith, I desire nothing better," cried Monsieur Bonacieux. "I shall not be sorry to see the face of an acquaintance."
"Bring in Monsieur D'Artagnan," said the commissary to the two guards.
The guards brought in Athos.
"Monsieur D'Artagnan," said the commissary, addressing Athos, "declare what passed between you and that other gentleman."
"But," cried Monsieur Bonacieux, "that is not Monsieur D'Artagnan that you show me there."
"What, not Monsieur D'Artagnan?" cried the commissary.
"By no means,"
answered Bonacieux.
"What is the gentleman's name?" demanded the commissary.
"I cannot tell you. I don't know him," replied Bonacieux.
"What? You do not know him?"
"No."
"You have never set eyes on him?"
"Yes, but I do not know his name."
"Your name?" demanded the commissary of Athos.
"Athos," answered the musketeer.
"But that is not the name of a man, it is the name of a mountain," cried the unfortunate commissary, who began to get confused.
"It is my name," calmly replied Athos.
"But you said your name was D'Artagnan."
"I said so?"
"Yes, you."
"The fact is that they said to me, 'You are Monsieur D'Artagnan.' I replied, 'Do you think so?' My guards said they were sure of it. I did not wish to contradict them. Besides, I might be mistaken."
"Sir, you mock the majesty of justice."
"Not at all," calmly replied Athos.
"You are Monsieur D'Artagnan?"
"You see that you still tell me so."
"But," cried Monsieur Bonacieux, "I tell you, Mr. Commissary, that there is not the smallest doubt.
Monsieur d'Artagnan is my lodger, and consequently, as he does not pay his rent, I know him only too well. Monsieur d'Artagnan is a young man of 19 or 20 years of age at most, and this gentleman is at least 30. Monsieur d'Artagnan is in the guards of Monsieur des Essarts, and this gentleman is in the company of Monsieur de Treville's musketeers. Observe the uniform.
By heavens, it is true, muttered the commissary. It is true, by God!
At this instant the door was quickly opened, and one of the turnkeys of the Bastille introduced a messenger, who gave the commissary a letter.
Oh, the wretch!
Exclaimed the commissary.
What? Of whom do you speak? It is not of my wife, I hope.
On the contrary, it is of her. Your affairs are in a nice state.
Do me the pleasure, said the exasperated mercer, to tell me, sir, how my affairs can be made worse by what my wife does whilst I'm in prison.
Because what she does is the consequence of an infernal plan arranged between you.
I swear to you, Mr. Commissary, that you are in the most profound error, that I know nothing in the world of my wife's actions, that I am completely ignorant of what she has done, and that if she has committed follies, I renounce her. I give her the lie, and I curse her.
And now, said Athos, if you have no further business with me, dismiss me. Your Monsieur Bonancieux is very tiresome. Take the prisoners back to their dungeons, said the commissary, pointing to Athos and Bonancieux, and guard them more strictly than ever.
Nevertheless, said Athos, with his usual tranquillity, your business is with Monsieur d'Artagnan. I do not well see how I can supply his place.
Do what I have ordered, cried the commissary, and the most solitary confinement, do you hear?
The two followed the guards, Athos shrugging his shoulders, and Monsieur Bonancieux uttering lamentations which might have softened the heart of a tiger. They took the mercer into the same dungeon where he had passed the night, and left him there throughout the whole day. Hour after hour did poor Bonancieux weep like a very mercer. He was not at all a man of warlike soul, as he himself told us. About 9 o'clock in the evening, just as he had made up his mind to go to bed, he heard steps in his corridor. These steps approached his dungeon. The door opened, and the guards appeared.
"Follow me," said a sergeant who commanded the guards.
"Follow you?" cried Bonancieux. "Follow you at this time of night? And where, my God?"
"Where we have orders to conduct you."
"But that is no answer."
"It is, nevertheless, the only answer you will get."
"Oh, Lord, oh, Lord," muttered the poor mercer. "Now I am lost."
He followed mechanically and without resistance. He went down the same corridor as before, crossed a first court, then a second floor. And then, at the entrance gate, he found a carriage surrounded by 4 horse guards. They made him enter this carriage. The sergeant placed himself at his side. The door was locked, and they both found themselves in a moving prison. The carriage proceeded slowly, like a funeral coach. Through the padlocked bars, the prisoner could only see the horses and the pavement. But, like a true Parisian as he was, Bonancieux recognized each street by its corners, its lamps, and its signs. At the moment they reached Saint-Paul, where the criminals of the Bastille were executed, he nearly fainted and crossed himself twice. He thought the carriage would have stopped there, but it went on, nevertheless. Farther on he was seized with great fear. It was in skirting the cemetery of Saint-Jean, where the state criminals were buried. One thing alone encouraged him, which was that before burying them one generally cut off their heads, and his head was yet upon his shoulders. But when the carriage took the road to La Grève, and he perceived the painted roof of the Hôtel de Ville, and saw that the carriage went under its colonnade, he thought it was all over with him, and wished to confess himself to the sergeant, and on the refusal of the latter uttered such piteous cries that the sergeant declared that if he continued to deafen him so, he would put a gag on him. This threat reassured him a little. If they meant to execute him at the Grève, it was scarcely worth while to gag him, as they had nearly reached the place of execution. In fact, the carriage crossed this fatal place without stopping. There was only the Croix du Trahoir, then, to fear, and the carriage took the exact road to it. This time there was no further room for doubt.
It was at the Croix du Trahoir that inferior criminals were executed. Bonacieux had flattered himself by considering that he was worthy of Saint-Paul or the Place de Grève. It was at the Croix du Trahoir that his journey and his destiny would end. He could not yet see this unhappy cross, but he felt it, as it were, loom before him. When he was only about 20 paces from it, he heard a noise, and the carriage stopped. This was more than poor Bonacieux could bear. Already crushed by the successive emotions he had experienced, he uttered a feeble cry, or rather groan, which might have been taken for the last sigh of a dying man, and fainted. 14. The Man of Meung. The mob that stopped the way was produced not by the expectation of seeing a man hanged, but by the contemplation of a man who was already hanging. After a moment's hindrance, the carriage proceeded on its way, passed through the crowd, went along the Rue Saint-Honoré, and turning at the Rue des Bons Enfants, stopped at a low doorway. When the door opened, two guards, assisted by the sergeant, received Bonacieux in their arms, and pushed him into a court. They then made him ascend a staircase and placed him in an antechamber. All these operations were performed nearly mechanically, as far as he was concerned. He had walked as in a dream. He had seen things as through a mist. He had heard without understanding, and they might have executed him then without his making the slightest resistance or uttering an appeal for mercy. He remained passive on the bench, with his back resting against the wall, and his arms hanging down on the very spot where his guards had placed him. And yet, as in looking around him he saw nothing threatening, as no real danger was indicated, as the bench was comfortably stuffed, as the wall was covered with beautiful cordovan leather, and as long curtains of red damask held by gilt brackets hung before the windows, he became by degrees aware that his fears were exaggerated, and began to move his head from right to left, and vertically. At this motion, which no one opposed, he resumed a little courage, ventured to draw up one leg, and then the other. And, at last, supporting himself upon his hands, he raised himself on the bench, and found himself on his feet. At this moment an officer of pleasant appearance opened a door, exchanged a few words with some person in the next room, and then, turning towards the prisoner, said, "Is it you who are called Bonacieux?" "Yes, sir," stammered the mercer, more dead than alive. "At your service." "Enter." The officer bade the mercer precede him, and the latter, obeying without reply, entered a room where he appeared to be expected. It was a large cabinet, the walls of which were furnished with offensive and defensive weapons. A close and suffocating room, in which there was already a fire, although it was scarcely yet the end of September. A square table, loaded with books and papers, and on which there was unrolled an immense plan of the town of Rochelle, occupied the middle of the apartment. In front of the chimney-piece there stood a man of middle height, with a proud and haughty air, piercing eyes, a large forehead, and an emaciated countenance, which was yet further elongated by an imperial, surmounted by a pair of moustaches. Although this man was scarcely 36 or 37 years old, both imperial and moustaches were beginning to grow grey. His appearance, except that he wore no sword, was military, and his buff leather boots, which were yet slightly covered with dust, pointed out that he had been on horseback during the day. This individual was Armand Jean Duplessis, Cardinal de Richelieu. Not as he is represented, broken down like an old man, suffering like a martyr, his body shattered, his voice extinguished, buried in an enormous easy chair, no longer living but by the power of his genius, and no longer supporting the struggle against Europe but by the eternal energy of his extraordinary mind, but such as he really was at this period. That is, a skilful and gallant cavalier, already feeble in body, but upheld by that moral force which made him one of the most unparalleled of mankind, and now preparing, after sustaining the Duc de Nevers in his Duchy of Mantua, and taking Nîmes, Castres, and Elz, to drive the English from the Isle of Ré, and to undertake the siege of La Rochelle. At first sight, nothing denoted that it was the cardinal, and it was impossible for those who were unacquainted with his appearance to guess in whose presence they were.
The poor mercer remained standing at the door, whilst the eyes of the person we have been describing fixed themselves upon him as if they would penetrate his most secret thoughts.
"Is that this Bonacieux?"
he demanded, after a moment's pause.
"Yes, my lord," replied the officer.
"Very well. Give me those papers and leave us."
The officer took the papers indicated, gave them to him who asked for them, bowed to the very ground, and left the room. In these papers, Bonancieux recognized his examinations at the Bastille. From time to time, the man by the chimney-piece lifted his eyes from the papers, and plunged them like two poniards into the very heart of the poor mercer. At the end of 10 minutes' reading and 10 seconds' scrutiny of Bonancieux, he had made up his mind.
"That head has never conspired," murmured the cardinal. "But never mind. Let us see."
Then he said slowly,
"You are accused of high treason."
"That is what they have already told me, my lord," said Bonancieux,
giving his interrogator the same title that he had heard the officer give him.
"But I give you my oath that I knew nothing about it."
The cardinal suppressed a smile.
"You have conspired with your wife, with Madame de Chevreuse, and with my Lord Duke of Buckingham."
"I admit, my lord," replied the mercer, "I have heard all those names mentioned by her."
"And on what occasion?"
"She said that the Cardinal de Richelieu had enticed the Duke of Buckingham to Paris to destroy him and the Queen."
"She said that, did she?"
cried the cardinal with great violence.
"Yes, my lord. But I told her that she was wrong in saying such a thing, and that his eminence was incapable—"
"Hold your tongue! You are a fool!"
replied the cardinal.
"That is exactly what my wife said to me, my lord."
"Do you know who carried off your wife?"
"No, my lord."
"But you had some suspicions?"
"Yes, my lord. But as these suspicions appeared to displease the commissary, I have them no longer."
"Your wife has escaped. Did you know that?"
"Not at the time, my lord. I learned it since I have been in prison from the commissary, who is a most amiable man."
The cardinal suppressed another smile.
"Then you do not know what has become of your wife since her escape?"
"Not positively, my lord, but she has probably returned to the Louvre."
"At 1 o'clock this morning she had not yet returned there."
"Oh, good God! But what can have become of her?"
"Have no fear. It will soon be known. Nothing escapes the cardinal. The cardinal knows everything."
"In that case, my lord, do you believe that the cardinal will tell me what has become of my wife?"
"Perhaps so. But it is necessary first that you should tell me all you know in relation to the connection of your wife with Madame de Chevreuse."
"But, my lord, I know nothing about it. I never saw her."
"When you went to fetch your wife from the Louvre, did she return directly to your house?"
"Scarcely ever. She had business to transact with the Queen's drapers, to whom I convoyed her."
"And how many linen drapers were there?"
2, my lord."
"Where do they live?"
"One in the Rue Vaugirard, and the other in the Rue de la Harpe."
"Did you accompany your wife into these houses?"
"Never, my lord. I always waited for her at the door."
"And what excuse did she make for entering alone?"
"None. She told me to wait, and I waited."
"You are a most accommodating husband, my dear Monsieur Bonancieux," said the cardinal.
"He has called me my dear Monsieur," said the mercer to himself. "Upon my faith, things are taking a good turn."
"Should you know those doors again?"
"Yes."
"Do you know the numbers?"
"Yes."
"What are they?"
"Number 25 in the Rue Vaugirard, and number 75 in the Rue de la Harpe."
"Good," said the cardinal, and taking a silver bell, he rang it. "Go," said he in a low voice to the officer who entered. "Go and find Rochefort, and tell him to come here directly if he is within."
"The Count is already here," said the officer, "and requests an immediate audience of your eminence."
"Your eminence?" muttered Bonancieux, who knew that such was the title ordinarily given to the cardinal.
"Your eminence!"
"Let him come in, then. Let him come in," said Richelieu eagerly.
The officer hurried out of the room with that rapidity with which the cardinal was generally obeyed by his followers.
"Your Eminence!"
again muttered Bonancieux, rolling his eyes in astonishment. 2 seconds had scarcely elapsed after the officer left the room before the door opened again and another person entered.
"It is he!"
exclaimed Bonancieux.
"Who is he?" demanded the cardinal.
"He who ran away with my wife!"
The cardinal rang a second time, and the officer reappeared.
"Put this man into the hands of the 2 guards, and let him wait till I send for him."
"No, my lord, no, it is not he!"
exclaimed Bonancieux.
"No, I was mistaken. It is another person, not at all like him. The gentleman is an honest man."
"Take away that simpleton," said the cardinal.
The officer took him by the arm and led him to the antechamber, where he was met by the 2 guards. The person who had last entered impatiently followed Bonancieux with his eyes till he was gone, and when the door was closed behind him,
"They have met,"
he said, eagerly approaching the cardinal.
"Who?"
demanded the cardinal.
"Those 2.
"The queen and the duke,"
cried the cardinal.
"Yes."
"And where?"
"At the Louvre."
"Are you sure?"
"Perfectly sure."
"Who told you of it?"
"Madame de Lannoy, who is entirely devoted to your Eminence, as you well know."
"Why did she not tell you sooner?"
"Either by chance or by mistrust, the queen made Madame de Sourgis sleep in her room, and kept it throughout the day."
"Very well. We have been beaten. Let us try to have our revenge."
"Be assured that I will assist your Eminence with all my soul."
"How did this happen?"
"At 12:30, the queen was with her women."
"Where?"
"In her bedchamber, where a pocket handkerchief was brought her from her seamstress."
"Well?"
"The queen immediately showed great emotion, and grew pale under her rouge."
"Well, what then?"
"Nevertheless, she arose, and in an agitated voice said, 'Ladies, wait 10 minutes for me. I will return.' Then, opening the door of her alcove, she went out."
"Why did not Madame de Lannoy come and tell you directly?"
"There was no certainty about the matter. Besides, the queen had said, 'Ladies, wait for me,' and Madame de Lannoy dared not disobey her majesty."
"And how long did the queen remain absent from her room?"
3/4 hour.
"Did none of her women accompany her?"
"Only Doña Estefana."
"And she returned?"
"Yes, but only to take a small rosewood casket, bearing her initials, with which she went out again directly."
"And when she came back, finally, did she bring the casket with her?"
"No."
"Does Madame de Lannoy know what the casket contained?"
"Yes, the diamond studs which His Majesty presented to the Queen."
"And she came back without the casket?"
"Yes."
"Then the opinion of Madame de Lannoy is that she gave this casket to Buckingham?"
"She is sure of it."
"How so?"
"During the day, Madame de Lannoy, in her office of tirewoman to the Queen, looked for this casket, appeared uneasy at not finding it, and ended by inquiring for it of the Queen.
And then the Queen..."
"The Queen blushed deeply, and answered that, having the evening before broken one of the studs, she had sent it to her jewellers to be repaired."
"You must go there, and ascertain whether that is true or not."
"I have been."
"Well, and the goldsmith?"
"The goldsmith has heard nothing about it."
"Good. Good. Rochefort, all is not lost, and perhaps all is for the best."
"The fact is that I have no doubt but what the genius of your Eminence may repair the errors of my agent.
Is that what you mean?"
"It was just what I was about to say, if your Eminence had permitted me to finish the sentence."
"Now, do you know where the Duchesse de Chevreuse and the Duke of Buckingham concealed themselves?"
"No, my lord. My agents have no positive information upon that point."
"I know it myself, though."
"You, my lord?"
"Yes, or at least I have no doubt of it. They lived, the one in the Rue Vaugirard, at number 25, and the other in the Rue de la Harpe, number 75.
"Would your Eminence wish me to arrest them both?"
"It is too late. They will be gone."
"Never mind.
There is no harm in trying. Take 10 of my guards and ransack the 2 houses. It shall be done, my lord." So saying, Rochefort rushed from the room. When the cardinal was left alone, he remained a moment in thought, and then rang a 3rd time. The officer who had come before appeared again. "Bring in the prisoner," said the cardinal. Master Bonancieux was again brought in, and at a sign from the cardinal, the officer withdrew. "You have deceived me," said the cardinal with great severity.
"I," cried Bonancieux, "I deceive your eminence?"
"When your wife went to the Rue Vaugirard and the Rue de la Harpe, she did not go to linen drapers."
"Good God! To whom did she go, then?"
"She went to see the Duchesse de Chevreuse and the Duke of Buckingham."
"Yes," said Bonancieux, with a flash of recollection. "Yes, exactly so. Your eminence is right. I often told my wife that it was astonishing that linen drapers should live in such houses, in houses which had no signs. And every time I said so, my wife began to laugh. Ah, my lord," he continued, throwing himself at the feet of his eminence, "it is plain that you are the cardinal, the great cardinal, the man of genius whom all the world reveres."
The cardinal, small as was the triumph to be achieved over a being so vulgar as was Bonancieux, did not the less enjoy it for a moment. Then, as if a new idea struck him, he smiled, and, stretching out his hand to the mercer, "Rise, my friend," said he. "You are a worthy fellow."
"The cardinal has taken my hand. I have touched the hand of the great man," exclaimed Bonancieux. "The great man has called me his friend."
"Yes, my friend, yes," said the cardinal, in that paternal tone which he was sometimes able to assume, but which only deceived those who did not know him. "And as you have been unjustly suspected, we must make you some amends. Here, take this bag of 100 pistoles and forgive me."
"I forgive you, my lord?"
said Bonancieux, hesitating to take the bag from a fear that this supposed gift was only a jest.
"But you were quite at liberty to have me arrested. You were quite at liberty to send me to the torture. You were quite at liberty to hang me. You are the master, and I should not have the smallest word to say against it. Forgive you, my lord? But you cannot mean that."
"Ah, my dear Monsieur Bonancieux, you are very generous. I see it, and I thank you. But you must take this bag, and then you will go away not very discontented, will you?"
"I go away perfectly enchanted, my lord."
"Adieu, then, or rather, au revoir, for I hope that we shall see each other again."
"As often as my lord may please. I am at your eminence's command."
"It shall be often, depend upon it, for I have found your conversation quite charming."
"Oh, my lord!"
"Farewell, till our next meeting, Monsieur Bonancieux. Till our next meeting."
Bonancieux, at a sign from the cardinal's hand, bowed to the very ground, and then backed himself out of the room. When he was in the anteroom, the cardinal heard him in his enthusiasm crying out at the top of his voice,
"Long live his eminence! Long live the great cardinal!"
Richelieu listened with a smile to this noisy manifestation of the enthusiastic feelings of Master Bonancieux, and, when his shouts were lost in the distance, "There," he said, "is a man who would henceforth die for me." The cardinal then set himself to examine with great attention the map of La Rochelle, which was spread out upon the table, and to mark with a pencil the position of the famous breakwater which, 18 months afterwards, closed the port of the besieged city. Whilst he was most deeply occupied with these strategic meditations, the door opened, and Rochefort reappeared.
"Well," said the cardinal with vivacity, which proved what consequence he attached to the intelligence that he expected from the count.
"Well," said the latter, "a young woman, between 26 and 28 years old, and a man of about 35 or 40 years of age, have really lodged in the houses indicated by your eminence. But the woman left last night, and the man this morning."
"It was they!"
exclaimed the Duke, whose eyes were fixed upon the clock. "But now," he continued, "it is too late to follow them. The Duchess is at Tours, and the Duke at Boulogne. It is in London that they must be overtaken." "What are your Eminence's commands?" "Let not one word be said of what has passed. Let the Queen remain in perfect peace of mind. Let her be ignorant that we know her secret. Let her believe that we are hunting after some conspiracy. Send me Séguier, the Keeper of the Seals." "And this man? What has your Eminence done with him?" "What man?" demanded the Cardinal. "This Bonancieux." "I have done all that could be done with him. I have set him to spy upon his wife." The Count de Rochefort bowed low, like a man who felt the great superiority of his master, and withdrew. As soon as the Cardinal was again alone, he seated himself once more and wrote a letter, which he sealed with his private signet, and then rang his bell. The officer entered for the fourth time. "Tell Vitry to come here," said the Cardinal, "and order him to be ready for a journey." In another moment the man he had sent for was standing before him, booted and spurred. "Vitry," said he, "you must go off at once, without an instant's delay, to London. You must not stop one moment on the road, and you will give this letter to my lady. There is a check for 200 pistoles. Go to my treasurer and get the money. You shall have the same sum if you return in 6 days, having performed my commission with success." The messenger, without answering one word, bowed, took the letter and the order for 200 pistoles, and left the room. These were the contents of the letter. "My lady, be present at the first ball where you can meet the Duke of Buckingham. He will have on his doublet 12 diamond studs. Get close to him, and cut off 2. As soon as these studs are in your possession, let me know it." 15. Civilians and Soldiers. On the day after these events had happened, as Athos had not returned to them, D'Artagnan and Porthos informed Monsieur de Tréville of his disappearance. As for Aramis, he had requested leave of absence for 5 days, and it was said that he was at Rouen on some family affairs. Monsieur de Tréville was the father of his soldiers, the humblest individual amongst them from the time that he put on the uniform of the company, was as certain of his assistance and support as Monsieur de Tréville's own brother could have been. He went, therefore, at once to the criminal lieutenant. The officer who commanded at La Croix Rouge was sent for, and from various inquiries it was ascertained that Athos was at that time lodged at Fort L'Evêque. Athos had been subjected to the same trials as we have seen Bonancieux exposed to. We have witnessed the confrontation of the two prisoners. Athos, who till then had said nothing from fear that D'Artagnan had not had the time he needed, from that moment declared that his name was Athos and not D'Artagnan. He added that he knew neither Monsieur nor Madame Bonancieux, that he had never spoken either to the one or the other, and that he had gone at about 10 at night to pay a visit to his friend, Monsieur D'Artagnan. But until that hour he had been at Monsieur de Tréville's, where he had dined. 20 witnesses, he added, could confirm this fact, and he named many distinguished gentlemen, amongst whom was the Duc de la Trémouille. The second commissary was as much surprised as the first at this simple but firm declaration of the musketeer, on whom he would gladly have taken that revenge which civilians so much love to take on soldiers. But the names of Tréville and La Trémouille demanded consideration. Athos was, therefore, sent to the Cardinal, but his Eminence was, unfortunately, at the Louvre with the King. It was just at this time that Monsieur de Tréville, having in vain sought Athos from the lieutenant and the governor of Fort L'Evêque, came to make an application to His Majesty, to whom he had, as captain of the musketeers, the right of immediate access upon all occasions. The prejudices of the king against the queen are well known, prejudices which were skilfully fostered by the cardinal, who, in political intrigues, had much greater fear of women than of men. One of the chief causes of this prejudice was the friendship of the queen for Madame de Chevreuse. These two women gave His Eminence more uneasiness than the Spanish War, the rupture with England, and the embarrassment of the finances all combined. He was convinced that Madame de Chevreuse served the Queen, not only in political intrigues, but, what was far more vexatious to him, in amorous intrigues as well. At the first word which the Cardinal had uttered, that Madame de Chevreuse, who was exiled to Tours, and had been supposed to be in that city, had come to Paris, and had stayed there 5 days, escaping the police, the King became furiously enraged. At once capricious and a false husband, Louis still wished to be distinguished as the just and the chaste. Posterity will, with difficulty, understand this character, which history explains not by reasoning, but by facts. But when the Cardinal added that not only had Madame de Chevreuse been to Paris, but that the Queen had renewed her friendship with her by means of one of those mysterious correspondences which were then called cabals, when he affirmed that he, the Cardinal, had all but unravelled the threads of this intrigue, when, at the moment that he was about to detect in the very fact, provided with the fullest proofs, an emissary of the Queen, who was in communication with the exile, a musketeer, had dared violently to interrupt the course of justice by falling, sword in hand, upon the honest officers of the law, who had been charged to examine the whole affair with impartiality, in order to lay it before the King, Louis was no longer able to restrain himself. He took a step towards the Queen's apartments, with that pale and speechless indignation which, when it burst out, led that prince to acts of the most unfeeling cruelty. And yet, in all this, the Cardinal had not said one word concerning the Duke of Buckingham. It was at that moment that Monsieur de Treville entered, cool, polite, and with a manner perfectly unobjectionable. Warned of what had taken place by the presence of the Cardinal, and by the change in the King's countenance, Monsieur de Treville felt himself as strong as Samson in the presence of the Philistines. The King had already placed his hand upon the handle of the door, but at the noise of Monsieur de Treville's entrance he turned round. "You come in good time, sir," said His Majesty, who, when his passions were thoroughly excited, never dissembled. "For I hear fine things of your musketeers." "And I," said Treville coolly, "have fine things to tell you of your civilians." "What is that you say?" said the King haughtily. "I have the honour to inform your Majesty," said Treville in the same tone, "that a party of lawyers, commissaries, and police agents, people very respectable in their way, but very bitter, as it appears, against the military, have presumed to arrest in a house, to drag through the public streets, and to cast into Fort l'Evêque, and all this under an order which they refuse to show me, one of my musketeers, or rather of yours, sir, of irreproachable conduct, of an almost illustrious reputation, and favourably known to your Majesty, Monsieur Athos."
"Athos," said the King mechanically. "Yes, I certainly do know that man."
"Your Majesty may remember," said Monsieur de Treville, "Monsieur Athos is the musketeer who, in the vexatious duel that you heard of, had the misfortune to wound Monsieur de Cahusac severely. By the by, my lord," continued Treville, addressing the Cardinal, "Monsieur de Cahusac is entirely recovered, is he not?"
"Yes, thank you," said the Cardinal, biting his lips with anger.
"Monsieur Athos," continued Treville, "had gone to visit one of his friends who was from home, a young Bernese, a cadet in His Majesty's Guards, in the company of Essard. But scarcely had he settled himself in his friend's room and taken up a book whilst waiting, when a cloud of bailiffs and soldiers mingled together laid siege to the house and broke open several doors."
The Cardinal here made the King a sign, which signified, "It was on account of the business which I have been telling you."
"We know all that," said the King, "for it was all done in our service." "And was it," asked Treville, "in your Majesty's service also that one of my musketeers, who was perfectly innocent, has been seized, placed between two guards like a criminal, and marched through the midst of an insolent crowd, although he is a gallant man, who has shed his blood for your Majesty 10 times, and is yet ready to shed it again?"
"Bah," said the King, somewhat shaken, "and was that really the way of it?"
"Monsieur de Treville does not say,"
replied the cardinal with the greatest indifference, that this innocent musketeer, this gallant man, had only 1 hour before attacked, sword in hand, 4 commissaries delegated by me to collect information concerning an affair of the greatest importance.
"I defy your eminence to prove it," cried Treville, with true Gascon frankness and true military bluntness. "For an hour before, Monsieur Athos, who, I can assure you, is a man of the noble origin, did me the honour, after having dined with me, of conversing in my drawing-room with the Count de Chalon and the Duc de la Tremouille."
The king looked at the cardinal.
"It is proved by a deposition," said the cardinal, in answer to the mute interrogation of the king, "and the individuals who were ill-treated have prepared what I have now the honour to present to your majesty."
"Is the affidavit of a civilian of equal value with the word of honour of a soldier?"
demanded Treville fiercely.
"Come, come, Treville, be silent," said the king.
"If His Eminence has any suspicions against one of my musketeers," replied Treville, "the justice of the cardinal is so well known that I should myself demand an inquiry."
"In the house in which this attack on justice has been made," said the immovable cardinal, "there lodges, I believe, a Bernese, a friend of the musketeer."
"Your eminence probably alludes to Monsieur D'Artagnan."
"I allude to a protégé of yours, Monsieur de Treville."
"Yes, your eminence, precisely so."
"Do you not suspect this young man of having led Monsieur Athos astray?"
"Monsieur Athos, a man nearly double his own age?" broke in Monsieur de Treville. "No, sir. Besides, Monsieur d'Artagnan passed the evening at my house."
"Ah," said the cardinal, "everybody seems to have passed the evening at your house."
"Does His Eminence doubt my word?"
exclaimed Treville, his face flushed with anger.
"No, God forbid," said the cardinal. "But only at what hour was he at your house?"
"Oh, as to that, I can speak with certainty to your eminence, for as he entered, I remarked that it was 9:30 by the clock, although I had believed it to be later."
"And at what hour did he leave your hotel?"
"At 10:30, exactly 1 hour after this event happened."
"But at least Monsieur Athos was seized in that house, in the Rue des Fossoyeurs," said the cardinal, who did not for a moment doubt the loyalty of Monsieur de Treville, yet felt that victory was leaving him.
"Is it unlawful for a friend to visit a friend, or for a musketeer of my company to keep company with a guard of Monsieur des Essarts?"
"Yes, when the house where he associates with his friend is suspected."
"This house is suspected, Treville," said the king. "Perhaps you did not know that."
"Indeed, sire, I did not know it. But although it might be suspected, I deny that it was in that part which Monsieur d'Artagnan inhabits. For I can assure you, sir, that if I may believe what he has said, that there does not exist a more devoted servant of your majesty or a more profound admirer of the cardinal."
"Is it not this d'Artagnan who wounded Jussac in that unfortunate encounter which took place one day near the convent des Carmes des Chaux?"
demanded the king, looking at the cardinal, who coloured with spite.
"And wounded Bernajoux the next day?"
"Yes, sire, yes. It is the same. Your majesty has a good memory."
"Come, what shall we decide upon?" said the king.
"That concerns your majesty more than me," answered the cardinal. "I assert his guilt."
"And I deny it," said Treville. "But His Majesty has judges. Let them determine on the affair."
"Exactly so," said the king. "Let us refer the matter to the judges. It is their business to judge, and they shall judge it."
"Only," said Treville, "it is a sad thing in these unhappy times in which we live that the purest life, the most indisputable virtue, cannot secure a man from disgrace and persecution. The army will be but little satisfied. I can answer for it at being the object of such rigorous treatment at the hands of the police."
The expression was imprudent, but Treville had thrown it out purposely. He wished for an explosion, because the mine flames out as it explodes, and the flame enlightens us.
"The police!" cried the king, taking up Treville's words. "Affairs of the police! And what do you know about them, sir? Busy yourself with your musketeers, and don't perplex my brain. It would seem, to hear you, that if a musketeer is arrested, France is imperiled. Gah, what a fuss about a